This episode is brought to you by Audi Canada.
The Canadian Medical Association has partnered with Audi Canada to offer CMA members a preferred incentive on select vehicle models. Purchase any new qualifying Audi model and receive an additional cash incentive based on the purchase type. Details of the incentive program can be found at audiprofessional.ca. Explore the full line of vehicles available to suit your lifestyle. The Audi driving experience is like no other.
I'm Dr. Jillian Horton, host of MedLife with Dr. Horton on CMAJ Podcasts. I'm a general internist and associate chair of the Department of Internal Medicine and the director of the Alan Kloss Health Humanities Program at the Max Rady College of Medicine in Winnipeg, Manitoba. I also host Insights, Arts, Medicine, Life at the National Arts Center in Ottawa. My guest today is Dr. Maryam Hamidi, who's here to discuss the topics of nutrition and sleep and how the two are related to one another. Dr. Hamidi is the Associate Director of Scholarship and Health Promotion at the Stanford Medicine WellMD, WellPhD Center, and a researcher in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences. She completed her master's and doctoral studies in clinical nutrition, nutritional epidemiology, and medical sciences at the University of Toronto. Over the course of her career, she has authored many highly cited scientific papers on nutrition and physician well-being. I've reached her at the studios at Stanford University in California. Dr. Hamidi, thank you for joining me today.
It's a pleasure being here.
So the first question I want to ask you, you are a person who is working at the intersection of physician health and nutritional sciences. Can you tell me more about how you ended up in this fascinating area of work?
I think it's a good story. So I, as you mentioned, completed my PhD, and then afterwards I was working in 2012. And since 2002, I was working at Toronto General Hospital Osteoporosis Clinic with Angela Chung. And I did my PhD with her as well. So during this whole time, my entire focus was always on postmenopausal women health, in particular when it came to bone health and nutrition. So most of my work was in relation to making sure that people are maintaining their bone density, and same with people who have prostate cancer and they were on androgen deprivation therapy and also needed to take care of their bones via lifestyle strategies. So while I was working on these projects, one of my friends who was working at Air Canada, one day he reached out to me and said, Maryam, you know, we need someone to teach our pilots about nutrition and management of sleep and fatigue. I know myself that when I eat better, I feel less tired. So I would imagine that there is something else going on. There must be some science to it. Do you know anyone who does that? So I started looking, and I couldn't really find anyone who was specializing in nutrition and fatigue management in the way that they were looking for. So I told him, I can't find anyone. He said, can you do it? I'm like, yeah, I know. I kind of did my PhD for 7 years. I think I can learn about that. So I started learning more and putting together a package for pilots, and I started teaching Air Canada pilots about fatigue management and nutrition and how they could reduce their fatigue and also feel more alert and less sleepy during their long-haul flights. At the same time, I was still working at Toronto General with physicians, and then I realized there is a parallel universe going on there between medicine and aviation, in that, you know, physicians, just like pilots, work really long hours. They don't have access to healthy food. They're often trapped the same way pilots are trapped in their cockpit. Physicians are trapped in their workplaces, in OR areas, in their clinics, in emergency medicine rooms. And it's a similar situation that, in fact, sometimes it's worse for physicians because they can't even eat or drink in specific areas due to infection control and other policies. So I realized a lot of my physician colleagues, in particular residents and fellows, were a lot of times experiencing hunger, thirst, in addition to sleep deprivation, and the foods that were available to them weren't really healthy. So that made me think of, what about I bring what I'm learning in the realm of pilot and pilot's nutrition to physicians? So I reached out to Angela and said, you know, would you be interested if I write a review paper on this? And my colleague and also who was at the same time chief resident at Toronto General, Miranda Moggle, was also interested in doing that work. So we got together and we did a review of literature. We learned that actually Jane Lemire at the University of Calgary has been a pioneer in looking into physician nutrition under performance. So again, I've learned a lot from Jane, and also realized that there were very few people in the world who have been looking into this. So it became a passion and interest for me to do this work.
It's an amazing story. And, you know, one of the things that I remember being struck by the first time I heard you speak via Stanford was the fact that I'd never heard a conversation about this before in exactly the way that you tailored it. You know, so much of our advice tends to be generic and not tailored to who we are and what we do. So just leading into that, you have done so much work delineating the relationship between sleep and dietary behaviors. And of course, that relationship is complicated. So could you talk for a bit about that association, particularly in the context of a physician's work schedule? What are some of the major points that you've learned or observed over the years?
As you mentioned, a big part of it is sleep deprivation. And again, as you mentioned too, it's like this reciprocal cycle between sleep as well as stress, mood, and diet. So for example, we know that when people are sleep deprived, they are more likely to go for foods that are higher in calories and they are more rewarding. So they tend to be higher in added sugar, saturated fat, or salt. And also there are differences between men and women. Men tend to go for something like burgers or fries or something that's like higher in both fat and protein. And women tend to gravitate towards things that are more sweet and fatty. But in general, you know, we choose foods that are higher in calorie and comforting. And that can be for two reasons. We know that there are hormonal changes as a result of sleep deprivation that lead to wanting to eat more, even though we are not necessarily hungrier, and also changes in brain function. So in ways that we would engage in behaviors that are rewarding. So when it comes to food, like let's say if you're really sleep deprived and you are exposed to foods that are high in calories and not healthy, then it will be much harder for you to not have that sweet that is right in front of you. There's also another interesting thing that there are some studies that show that when we have higher blood sugar, we are more likely to have a stronger willpower and engage in behaviors that we are, or activities that we are dreading. So let's say, you know, it's 2 p.m. in the afternoon, you're exhausted, and you're about to see a patient that you dread seeing for whatever reason. A lot of times we call that like a pick-me-up. It makes sense for you to want to go and grab something sweet or something that basically lifts your mood and also increases your blood sugar, so then you can do what seems very difficult for you. There are animal studies to also suggest the same thing. For example, if there was a study on dogs and they were doing intravenous glucose injections, and they saw that, you know, dogs were more likely to try to take a treat outside of a complex box and not give up when they had higher blood sugar compared to when they didn't. So there is that as well. But going back to the sleep, we also know that diets that are high in saturated fat and sugar impair sleep and also mood. So, and also they can lead into weight gain, which then that can also lead to sleep apnea, for example. So it becomes this vicious cycle of people feeling tired and then wanting to eat more unhealthy foods, and the cycle repeats itself.
Can we talk for a minute about the contrast between the effects of good and poor nutrition on the brain and the body in terms of the things that are of the most interest to physician performance?
So I wanted to mention that there are gender differences there too. So we know there are a couple of studies that show that women are more sensitive to the effects of diet. So women would benefit greatly from having a diet that is high in fruits and vegetables, in particular green leafy vegetables and healthy fats. Whereas men have a bit of a more flexibility in that. And that means, like, for example, if men are having an average diet, they don't suffer the consequences as much as women do. For men, it's like if they have a purely junk food diet, they suffer the consequences. So that's kind of an interesting thing to keep in mind. And in the observational studies that we have done with our Stanford physicians, we looked at the dietary patterns, and we saw that physicians who were, I would say, had a preference, because it's really hard to, you know, self-reported dietary intake is always very tricky. Sometimes we report what we prefer to eat, not necessarily what we eat. So what we pick up is actually a combination of what people do and what people prefer to do. So in this study, we found that people who had a preference for diets that were higher in green leafy vegetables, basically a Mediterranean plant-based diet, had lower rates of sleep-related impairment. And that's basically feeling tired and not alert during the day, compared to those who had a preference for those diets that were high in saturated fat and added sugars. And you also mentioned, in the context of, you know, challenges that physicians experience, one of the things that often comes to my mind is thinking about people who are in or the whole entire team, physicians, nurses, and everybody else who's in the room. A lot of times they go without food and water for long periods of time. And I mentioned the effects of food on performance, but also hydration. We know, for example, dehydrated pilots have worse flight performance. Soccer referees, they make judgment mistakes when they're dehydrated. Same for, also, there's a study on physicians that their short-term memory was impaired when they were dehydrated. And then I think all of us have also experienced, you know, how our mood changes when we are hungry. So imagine you have a room full of people who are thirsty and hungry. And I always wonder, what if, like, part of the aggression that we see in OR culture is because people are deprived of food and water, as well as, you know, not being able to use the washroom. And then the other thing too is dehydration changes our visual acuity and also attention. So imagine a neurosurgeon who is dehydrated. And again, what if we can reduce a lot of medical errors if we could pay attention to proper nutrition and hydration for our operating rooms? And that applies to emergency medicine as well. And also any clinician in any setting, in fact, when they are feeling tired or doing repetitive work, they are more likely to make mistakes if they don't have proper hydration and nutrition.
One thing I think people might wonder hearing you say that is, how do those studies tend to define dehydration, or what does that actually translate into for most of us in terms of oral fluid, you know, the difference between what we would have to take in to be replete?
So there are many ways. One of the ways that the simplest way that they use for athletes, to summarize and make it very simple, is we want our urine to look like lemonade, not apple juice. I know there are, you know, medical conditions, you know, the B vitamins, food, they can change the urine color, but you can always be your own control and compare you to yourself. And that's one easy way of knowing if you are having enough water or not. There are, in the studies, they usually look at urine output. That's one way of measuring how dehydrated people are, or loss of weight. And more recent studies show that we actually don't even need to be dehydrated, just not having enough. They call it hypohydration. So if we're even mildly dehydrated or have hypohydration, that alone can affect our mood. There was one interesting study that looked at providing healthy meals and water to healthcare providers who were working night shifts, and they didn't really find much in regards to providing healthy food. But one interesting finding was that people who had about 500 milliliters of water, they tend to feel better and feel less aggressive during their night shifts. So water can be just one simple strategy to improve our mood, in particular during night shifts.
So that is one concrete takeaway, and I love it because it's so simple and everybody can remember, you know, 500 milliliters of water can make a difference. I'm wondering, based on your extensive experience, if you're coaching physicians around optimizing their nutrition in their own work setting and their hydration, what are some of your favorite tips and tricks to overcoming the barriers to being hydrated and to eating well?
So for hydration, a few things that might be helpful to keep in mind is that it's better to have little bits of water throughout the day instead of, you know, chugging 500 milliliters of water all at once, because your body wouldn't retain that and will get rid of it pretty quickly. And if we want to kind of reduce the number of washroom visits, that's one way of doing that. So basically gradually having water throughout the day. So if I tell that to physicians, they're like, well, good luck. I really don't have time to do this. It's not possible for me to carry a water bottle everywhere. But some people can and do. So one strategy is to choose a water bottle that you love and it becomes your friend. So the same way sometimes, you know, people become friends with their phones, and having a case that they like also helps with that. Choosing a water bottle that it's easy for you to carry and becomes like your best friend can help with remembering to carry it around and also drinking water from it. Another way, I call it time release fluids. That's having fruits and vegetables, because it will give you some time for the water in fruits and vegetables to be released. So the act of digestion also releases some water, which can then be reabsorbed if we are dehydrated. So having fruits and vegetables is one way. Having also specific times in the day that we remind ourselves to drink. So waking up in the morning, having a cup of water. If you are going to a meeting, having a cup of water with you, or drinking a cup of water during the meeting, in your commute to work, in the way back from work, and then with every meal. So that way you can have at least about 5 cups of water per day. It's not easy. I've been trying to do that myself. I often remember to drink as soon as I wake up and during meetings. Those have been helpful to me. And for physicians, depending on their specialty and their schedules, a lot of times carrying the water bottle has been the most helpful one, as well as having fruits and vegetables.
Another thing I found myself thinking about as you talk about this potential relationship between aggression and, you know, mild dehydration is, again, ties into the work on commensality. You know, and if you think of 20 years ago when I was first in my career and or training, you know, most meetings, most gatherings, even most rounds, in addition to food, there'd be a jug of water on the table with cups. And of course, with our shift to those things not being provided, paid for, part of either academic or institutional life, it's interesting you make me think that that's another potential thing that we have lost, is just those inadvertent opportunities that we used to provide people to hydrate that also disappeared along with food and common space.
And I also want to go back. You asked about food, and I didn't mention that, and probably unconsciously, because it's such a difficult thing to tackle. In particular, when I'm working with residents, it's really difficult to tell them, you know, try to eat healthier, because a lot of times they're working about 80 hours a week. And I got to experience that myself when I was doing a study last year, which involved studying residents during night shifts to see how their performance changes as we fed them different meal compositions. So I was working 80-hour weeks with them, and I realized what they were going through, how little time they have. And a lot of times it was, you know, for me, it was like I came home, I had 6 hours, and I had to decide whether I wanted to sleep, eat, take a shower, or do other self-care behaviors that were absolutely necessary. If someone came to me and told me, by the way, try to eat healthy, it would be infuriating to hear that. And I find that a lot of residents feel that way when I'm invited to give talks about nutrition and performance in physicians. So in that case, it becomes the responsibility of the organizations, healthcare organizations, GME administration, to make sure that residents and also all physicians and all healthcare providers, in fact, have access to healthy meals, to provide it in a way that's both affordable and accessible, and that create areas for healthcare providers and to sit and eat together for the commensality reason that you mentioned, creates collegiality. People often talk around food, and then once it's over, they kind of move on and they had a moment of, you know, connecting with each other. A lot of times, physicians need to go to cafeterias or common areas where patients are. And one is like they don't have the time to wait in line, but also sometimes they just want some time away from patients so they can ground themselves and have a moment to themselves and not run into a patient who had a difficult encounter again while they are waiting to get their food. So it's really, really important to create the space and make it easy for physicians to eat healthy. I mean, they have the knowledge, and in my experience, every time that we have provided healthy food, no one has objected to it. That said, sometimes when we were working on changing the food options in our physician lounge, we got some complaints about, you know, removing soda and chips. It was kind of funny. But I also get, it goes back to that whole sleep deprivation and our preference for certain foods. And, you know, sometimes when we don't have control over everything else that's happening, you know, let's just have those options as well. Or the other way to go around it too is like we can provide healthy options, but then people would have, they always have the option of bringing whatever food preference they have, bringing that to work. But the main point is to make it easy for people to follow a healthy diet, which is not the case in most healthcare organizations right now.
There's one study that I think you shared with me at a different point in time, and it was around patients' perceptions when physicians consume food or drink in front of them.
Right. Yes, that's one of the misconceptions, that it wouldn't be perceived as professional, or even sometimes the idea that it may be unkind to drink and eat in front of patients who cannot eat and drink. And there was a very small study not that small. I think they had around at least 100 people in the study in the UK, and they asked patients and hospital staff, do you think it would be, physicians shouldn't be eating and drinking in front of patients who can't eat and drink? And above 80% of people said there is no problem, that they would not have a problem if their physicians ate or drank in front of them. Another thing I wanted to mention is a few studies have looked at the causes of malnutrition in our hospitalized patients. And one of the interesting things that came up, and it was surprising to me, is one of the reasons is patient mealtimes being disrupted by either physicians or other healthcare professionals for medical procedures. And it goes to show how we don't really respect eating in a medical culture, and also sleeping too. A lot of times if you talk to people who have spent nights at hospital, they'll tell you it's impossible to sleep, like regardless how sick they feel. You know, with all the beeping and sounds and people walking in and turning on the light in the middle of the night, a lot of times patients want to go home so they can sleep, but also so they can eat, which is quite ironic, given that we are trying to help them recover. So that's another thing that I'm always thinking is like, you know, what if we had protected time for eating for both patients and physicians and all other healthcare professionals? So that was a time that everyone was eating and taking care of that aspect of life, which happens to be important, instead of a culture that doesn't value that at all.
Now, you talked about sleep, and I wonder if you could talk for a few minutes about how it's possible for us as physicians to form so-called good sleep habits when we take into consideration the long, often irregular shifts, the interruptions that we frequently face overnight when we're on call, and the workload that comes with the territory. What can a person actually do to cultivate a good sleep habit in the face of those circumstances?
I think this is also something that needs to be addressed by multiple, not just physicians themselves, but also the role that organizations play in that. So basically reducing all the redundancies in work, electronic health records, not having to work at home on the electronic health records and notes and charts. We have noticed that that's one of the reasons that physicians can't get enough sleep. And we have provided coaching option to physicians who have brought that to our attention. That would be one way. Other ways that individuals can handle that is knowing what their chronotypes are. You know, so we often talk about morning type people and night type people, but it's a lot more than that. You know, there are daytime people and there's like extreme morning people. And then there are people who are like moderately morning and then same thing at night. So there are different questionnaires that you can find out, you know, when will be the optimum time for you to wake up and what will be an optimum time to consider going to sleep. And like that alone, that knowledge can be very helpful. The other thing is if people are working really, really hard, sometimes they choose not to sleep, because then again that's more for our residents, that it's almost like they have no life if their only thing is they work and sleep. Sometimes they purposely choose not to sleep enough so that they can talk to their family members or hang out with their friends or socialize a little bit. So again, handling the workload is a huge part, and then the personal preferences and things that people can do. It's actually less of a control on that part. And then the last part would be there are some sleep education, and I'm not sure if that is provided or not, but concepts like anchor sleep, split sleep, that people can use depending on, you know, when the preference for sleeping at night is, and trying to protect that. So if they can take a nap before, or like basically break down their sleep into different chunks during the day, and making sure that they are sleeping. Let's say if somebody's usual bedtime is from 11 to 7 when they're on a night shift and they get a chance to sleep, have a bit of overlap between their usual patterns and when they take the naps. The split sleep is a different concept that basically you kind of break down your sleep during different chunks throughout the day. And the other part would be sometimes aviation does that. I think ideally it would be really nice to assign people who are, you know, early morning type people to like early morning shifts. That would be basically technology. Maybe in 10 years we could kind of do personalized shifts for people according to their chronotype. Therefore, no one would suffer. You know, like a person who is not a morning person, they can do a night shift, and someone who is like an early morning, they can do the morning shift. I'm being very idealistic, but that's something else that might be helpful.
Another thing I've heard you talk about is the strategic and evidence-based optimal use of caffeine for physicians. Can you talk a bit about that?
Right. Yes. So caffeine is a commonly used strategy to battle fatigue and improve alertness. And one of the ways to take best advantage of that is knowing the difference, for example, between coffee and tea. So tea has, in particular, green tea has an amino acid called L-theanine, and L-theanine works synergistically with coffee. And on its own, it has a calming effect. So, for example, if we are doing something that requires a lot of attention, but it tends to be more monotonous, like doing notes, green tea would be a better option for this kind of activity. Whereas if we are moving around and we need to do a task that requires attention switching, coffee would be a better choice. Another thing to keep in mind is the half-life of caffeine. So depending on if we are a fast metabolizer of caffeine or a slow metabolizer of caffeine, and usually everyone knows how sensitive they are to caffeine, is knowing that it can take between 3 to sometimes 8 hours to that's the half-life of caffeine. And a lot of times it's very effective for the first 3 hours, sometimes 5 hours. And beyond that point, it only disrupts sleep, but it doesn't really add to our alertness. So if we are feeling really tired at 3 p.m. and we have a cup of coffee, first of all, there is a delay. So it will take about 30 minutes to about 90 minutes for caffeine to be effective and to increase our alertness. So we wouldn't really feel alert until about 4:30 to 5. And that's basically when you're about to wrap up and go home. And you're in the car, it's like, oh, great, now I feel really alert. I needed this about an hour and a half ago. So knowing that time lag can be helpful also for another reason, and that's something that's called CAFNAP. So we can have a caffeinated beverage, tea, coffee, and take a nap. And by the time we wake up, so a nap that's about 30 minutes to 40 minutes, and by the time we wake up, the caffeine has kicked in and we've had our nap, and coffee also reduces sleep inertia. So a lot of times when we are really, really sleep deprived and we take a nap, we feel groggy afterwards. So coffee can help with overcoming that as well. So that's a good strategy to use, the calf nap. And also, again, being aware of that time lag and knowing that beyond 5 hours, it can only disrupt our sleep, not necessarily help with the alertness. So then we don't enter this vicious cycle of constantly feeling tired and having coffee or tea at the wrong time and disrupt our sleep.
This CAFNAP strategy is an example of such a practical thing that I learned from you last year. And, you know, sometimes my husband will see me having a cup of coffee right before I lie down to have a nap. And he says, like, what are you doing? But this, you know, the importance, it just illustrates that there are these things that we aren't really aware of in medicine when it comes to optimal performance under the difficult conditions that we work in. And if we know them, we actually can harness them and, again, get some locus of control over the things that tend to cause us the most distress in our lives.
That's right. And the other one that you just reminded me is for people who don't want to have caffeine is chewing gum. So there are some studies that also show that chewing a gum can help with reducing stress, can improve alertness. If we are feeling sleepy and we don't want to eat a snack or don't even have time, the act of chewing a gum can be helpful in those situations.
And what I'm struck by as you say that again is so often, and I've certainly seen this in medical education, learners will be criticized if they're chewing gum in a, you know, on rounds or in a in the ICU. I've seen that kind of thing before. And you just gave me this vivid recollection that when I was a resident, whenever I was about to do a procedure, I had no awareness that there was a scientific basis of it, but I always knew that if I chewed gum while I was doing it, it actually allowed me to download some of my stress, and I always felt more relax. So just like the drinking fluids or eating in front of patients, what another vivid example of how some of these myths that we've perpetuated about things that we should or shouldn't do actually have maybe diminished some of our capacity to be effective and useful. Another question that I want to ask you, when you think of organizations, you talked about Air Canada and your time at University Health Network, and of course now you're at Stanford. Can you tell me about some powerful realizations or organizational change that you have been able to affect in those consultations?
Yes. So actually, sometimes it's both success and failure stories. So one of the at Stanford, we tried to change the food options in the physician lounge, and that was received well. One of the main challenges often is the cost. So I remember giving a talk at the Chief Wellness Officer course that Stanford holds in June. And I met some of my physician colleagues again in September of that year, or October of that year, during a conference. And they're like, hey, Maryam, can we talk with you for a minute? I'm like, uh-oh, what's going on? So what had happened was, because I I guess I was convincing about the importance of nutrition in physician performance, they started offering healthy meals in their physician lounge. And what happened is over time, the cost of food in physician lounge went about from $2,000 to $3,000 to almost $18,000. And that was like, well, this is not sustainable. We can't do this. And one of the things that was happening is physicians are compassionate, altruistic people. It would be very difficult for them to go to a lounge and have access to healthy food and not think of all the other people in their team who are hungry and thirsty and probably also are at a financial disadvantage and not grab food for them. So a lot of times this strategy is, yes, we try to fix one problem, but if it's not an organization-wide and it's not inclusive of everyone who is taking care of patients, it just doesn't work. And a lot of times it's also in the case of Air Canada too, was, you know, me showing that, you know, the food that you're providing to pilots, this is Air Canada Rouge, a lot of times it's not being eaten. So like, you know, from the tray that you give them, maybe only 20% of it is eaten and the other 80% is wasted. So what if we kind of consider that the cost of waste and spend a little bit more on providing healthier food and then not have the waste? But again, that's only doable if we are doing it for everybody in healthcare organizations, not just a small group. And in particular, again, if we want to only take care of physicians, it's guaranteed that they're going to take care of everyone. So it will automatically happen.
Yeah. But again, I what I hear and what you're saying is it's coming back to the business case again, that, you know, singular strategies that are too localized can just set us up for more failure. So it's taking a much longer view, isn't it, towards the health of the organization as a whole, and seeing it sort of as an organism in a holistic way.
Exactly.
So if there's one final message you want clinicians to take away from your work, how would you summarize it?
I think the main thing would be to increase awareness about the importance of nutrition in short-term performance of physicians and also all other healthcare professionals. I think this is something that all the administrative people need to be aware of. All the program directors and their administrative people need to know about that as well. It's not, you know, sometimes I find that, let's say in some of the conferences that we go to, or even when foods are being ordered for physicians and residents, is the lack of knowledge by people who order those foods about the importance of nutrition on short-term performance. Not just, you know, a lot of times people know, you know, if you don't eat well, you may end up gaining weight and diabetes and heart disease, but not many people pay attention to how eating right now may affect our performance in about 4 hours from now. And I guess if a lot of people knew that, a lot of things would change rather rapidly. And again, increasing knowledge and every opportunity that we have to let other people learn about these important facts is most likely to bring change.
Actually, I have one final question for you. If people are interested in learning more about all of the issues you've talked about today, do you have favorite non-commercial resources online or books that you would direct them towards?
There is a book that Dr. Laura Roberts and Mickey Truckle at Stanford University have edited, The Art and Science of Physician Wellbeing. There is a book chapter on nutrition that I've contributed to, and I've tried to summarize all the points that I covered today in that book chapter. That's one good place to go to. And I'm trying to come up with, you know, resources that are available online. There is a two-page handout that I have on the WellMD website. I can share that link with you. I think this is an area that needs a lot more work to make sure that, you know, there is evidence-based information and something that's reliable and people can easily have access to instead of multiple random websites that are trying to sell something.
Dr. Hamidi, it has been an absolute pleasure speaking to you. I've learned a ton. I always do. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure speaking with you today.
I've been speaking with Dr. Maryam Hamidi, Associate Director of Scholarship and Health Promotion at the Stanford Medicine WellMD WellPhD Center and researcher in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences. If you'd like to hear more podcasts in the series MedLife with Dr. Horton, you can find them as part of CMAJ Podcasts on SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you find your podcasts. And please don't forget to subscribe and leave us a rating. This podcast was made possible in part by the support of the Alan Kloss Health Humanities Program. I'm Dr. Jillian Horton. Thank you for listening.